Accession number 28528, Reel 13.
Mr. Tony Pawson, Reel 13.
His comment went, "Then there is the ordeal of Lord Aldington, robust enough to spend 2 years challenging a tirade of fantasies, but then, when he has apparently won the day, finding that even his victory is turned against him, leaving him to fight on year after year through the interminable thickets of the law, without ever receiving a penny of the money awarded to him by the courts of the land. No wonder," Aldington exclaimed in despair, "when will this wicked nonsense cease when I was talking to him about the case?" So who were these people on whose behalf the BBC was to be party to unjust accusations? Were they indeed just simple poor peasant civilians who somehow had wandered far from their home and blundered into surrendering armies? Or were they perhaps the BBC version of innocent asylum seekers entitled to a friendly welcome and right to expect it? For some civilians, like those who had tagged along with the murderous Cossack division in Italy, solely in hope of protection by them, there could be nothing but sympathy if repatriated against their will. But the mass of those facing possible repatriation had fought with the Germans in betrayal of their country, and with many committing brutal crimes along the way. They were typified by that Cossack we rescued. He was from Damanov's Cossack division. This division had fought against its own countrymen since joining the Germans in the Caucasus in 1942. They stayed with them in the long retreat, earning a reputation through brutality and guerrilla expertise in fighting Soviet partisans. This attracted the notice of the notorious Himmler's deputy, Gottlob Berger, who put them under command of SS Obergruppenführer Lobornik, formerly a commander of the infamous Treblinka extermination camp in Poland. Their task was to rout Italian partisans troubling the Germans by their hold on an area north of Udine. They did indeed prove worthy of their German partners in bloodily achieving that objective. They then spent the winter garrisoning in villages there, terrorizing the inhabitants, commandeering their food for themselves and their plentiful livestock, and killing many of them. On the very day of our intervention to save that Cossack, Captain Nicholson reported in his SITREP, "The Cossack division operating with the Germans has murdered several hundred Italians." That was reported as unemotionally as if it was a matter of no concern to him. Next day, the 15th Army Group headquarters showed a great deal more concern in its instructions to the German commander at Bolzano. "A large band of Cossack troops under your command have been released from German command and are now terrorizing and looting villages and shooting local partisans." He was ordered to ensure orderly surrender of these forces, who were not only traitors, but with many of them patently involved in genuine war crimes, as Nicholson's report confirmed. It also confirms the fact that these were directly under German command. That led to the Cossack division surrendering in Austria, to the Damanov Cossack division surrendering in Austria, along with a mass of other Cossack forces who'd been fighting for the Germans and whose reputations were not dissimilar. As Rossinoli had commented, the crowds of Chetniks, Ustashi and the like, who had surrendered in general, had equally brutal reputations. As for the title of the BBC film, there could be no question of betrayal. What their status was as regards Britain had been spelled out long ago by Churchill in 1941. "Any man of state who marches with Hitler is our foe." That applies not only to organized states, but to all representatives of that vile race of quislings who make themselves tools and agents of the Nazi regime against their fellow countrymen in the land of their birth. It was also made clear then that by the Attorney General that Britain had no obligation or intention to grant asylum to those who had just wandered far from home, and even less to those in the above categories, as were the mass of those waiting for decisions about repatriation after surrendering. With the Russians close by demanding strict implementation of the Yalta Agreement, and Tito is also a threat, we would have felt we would have been able to understand the revulsion felt at forced repatriation by those who actually had to carry it out, even with these people's disgraceful record. Yet we would have felt betrayed indeed had the likes of Brigadier Toby Lowe been prepared to sacrifice our lives for theirs. They were, after all, traitors for whom in war there are always dire penalties, and many of them war criminals as well, as in the case of most of Damanov's division. They had willingly helped the Germans in the threat they represented to our country's existence, and more recently in prolonging for us that seemingly endless vista of blood, tears and toil. Such people have been worth very many divisions to the Germans at the cost of many Allied lives in its prolongation through them. So there were limits to the sympathy we could be expected to extend to such people, whose parlous predicament was of their own making, not ours. No wonder that many of them feared repatriation because of what they had done to their country and their countrymen. Finally, what were Tolstoy's collection of Yugoslav and Russian witnesses like? They were too varied to generalize about them, so a couple must suffice. First, there was Vladimir Ljotic, who had by then lived in Britain for 40 years and was a retired company accountant. Gray revealed at the trial he had been a member of the Serbian Volunteer Corps, with whom he marched over the Leuble Pass in step with his German partners as the column headed for surrender in Austria. A report from the British ambassador in Belgrade had described this corps as part of the forces of the Quisling Ladic government, a German puppet. The corps therefore included just the type of people Churchill had branded as vile and unwelcome. There was also a German leaflet, referred to by Gray, which mentioned these Serbian volunteers as fighting at the side of the Germans in the battle for Belgrade. In an attempt to distance himself from the Germans, Ljotic claimed that in the column, the Serbs had been under their own commander, not the German Obersailer. He added, surprisingly, that he had exchanged his original uniform for British battle dress, quotes, captured in the battles we had at the River Po, end quote. Their 6th Armoured Division had been fighting. So to the potential death penalty offence of being a traitor to his country, he appeared to add another of soldiering in his enemy's uniform. Sitreps of the time, especially some by Nicholson, put Sailor in total commander of the company, of the group coming over, as did the evidence of historian Dr. Knight, an expert in the subject. So it firmly placed the whole column under the commander of the German Obersailer. Another Tolstoy witness also claimed not to have been under German control, and even went so far as to say he had no contact with them. However, when Gray showed him a picture of the Slovene Dama Branki, with whom he served, all in German-type uniforms, his story changed. Under continued questioning, he gradually admitted that he had been under German command and had obeyed orders coming direct from the Germans. The trial in November 1989 had, of course, been confined to the specific issue of the libels against Aldington. The main plank of Tolstoy's accusations, for instance, had been that Aldington had acted against orders from his superiors, only for the evidence to show that he had, in fact, carried them out correctly and to the last letter. another main part of Tolstoy's accusations related to orders issued from 23rd May onwards, which he claimed were Aldington's. Aldington's disputed this from the start, but said he couldn't produce exact evidence of it 40 years later. Near the end, his view was confirmed, however, and that charge also collapsed. The son of Brigadier de Fontblanc found a diary entry of his father's that he had taken over from Aldington on 21st May, exactly as Aldington had claimed. Indeed, to such a degree did Tolstoy's case collapse that before the end, Gray was asking whether there was indeed any case left after so many of the charges had to be withdrawn. Soon after the trial, a report was issued following a detailed study by Lord Brimelow, Brigadier Cowgill, and the truly professional historian Christopher Booker, who then wrote an article titled The Victims of Tolstoy. This read at its end, "No one disputes the tragic nature of what happened in Austria in those few brief summer weeks. Of more immediate moral concern, however, might be the consequences of what Tolstoy himself has managed to do by the elaborate explanation for these events which he has concocted. We have devoted a whole chapter of our report to the extraordinary plight in which Harold Macmillan found himself in the last years of his life, when he found himself charged with a whole series of appalling and wholly imaginary crimes, of which it seemed many people were only too eager to believe he had been guilty. Lord Aldington may at least have been vigorous and determined enough to seek legal redress, and he may on paper have been awarded vast damages, but in reality it is he who will have to spend the rest of his life paying off his legal bills, while the man who levelled this farrago of false charges against him assiduously drums up sympathy from the media and floats on as if nothing very much had happened. No wonder I still feel deep anger at those uncaring people who, for purposes of their own, put outstanding Britons to cruel and unjustified suffering in their final years." And the start?
Yes.
When we had finally settled down in Austria with the no longer any threat from Tito, it turned out to be a country that we really could enjoy. Particularly myself as a very keen fisherman. The final little episode before it was all over was the taking back of a lady commissar from the Tito companies who had got left behind. Unfortunately, she was very ugly looking and somewhat smelly, and nobody was offering to take her to the Yugoslav border and hand her over there. So, as a keen fisherman, I rapidly said that I would do it, but only if I was allowed 2 days there, as I had heard of some very good trout streams near the border. Also, I had the good fortune that my company commander was the one with whom I had started, James Booth. Oddly, I had 4 or 5 company commanders in between, but we were back to where we started. James was also a Wickhamist, and he was also a keen fisherman. Indeed, he was regarded as the man who put in the most unusual claim for damages when breaking the sound barrier, started breaking people's glass houses and so on. His claim was that he'd been quietly fishing a Scottish loch and had just hooked a salmon and nearly played it out and was leaning forward with the net when the sound barrier was broken above him, and such was the effect on the fish that it dashed wildly away, pulled out all his line, broke the backing, and needless to say, escaped. So James put in a claim for the equipment lost and for the price of the salmon. Unsportingly, it was turned down. But sportingly, we very soon came to a nice agreement that when things were quiet, I would go fishing one day while he looked after the company, and he would go fishing the next day while I looked after the company. So that looked very well, went very well for us. There was also the luck for me that Brother Philip had ended in a town nearby which controlled a brilliant trout river called the Gook, and therefore if there was any need to get permission to fish that particular river, I had no difficulty. And this in fact became so well known that a message once came through that there was to be a banquet for General Alexander, and the two Paulsons were to be given a day's leave and expected to catch well over 50 fish for this banquet. So good was the gurk that we actually had no trouble in doing that. So there is that Wordsworth quote that in that day it was joy to be alive, but to be young was very heaven, and that really did apply to me. I was in my early 20s, we had the whole land at our disposal to do what we liked in, and there was all this marvellous fishing. And that was far from the only thing there was. One less respectable form of sport involved me in my first ever attempt as a defence lawyer. I was not at all versed in the law, and I had to defend a rifleman who was accused of rape. I was opposed, which I thought very unfair, by a QC from the Attorney General's office as prosecutor. However, with a brilliant Perry Mason type defence, I managed to get him off on the rape charge, only to find that that automatically left him having to admit a charge for fraternisation, which carried much the same penalty. So very little good I did him, and very little I learnt about the law. So that was part of the, fairly early on, we had innumerable problems keeping the stream of instructions or rules or whatever that came from AMGOT, as it was called, or Allied Military Government of Occupied Territories. And I was again in trouble on breaching the fraternisation law when we had got around to playing football. I was even then quite a good football player, and was later to become the only person since before the war, which still applies now, to have played as an amateur in both county cricket and first division football for Charlton as it then was. So I was good enough in fact to be told to captain the divisionals football team, and we had taken over the Verona. We were then had been moved from Austria to Italy to Verona, and we had taken over their football ground, and I was approached, which we used ourselves, which of course was banned for them, and I was approached by the chairman of Verona, who asked if we would play a friendly game against them. Well, I thought that sounded fine, and nobody could mind at that, so I agreed to that, to happen the next day or soon thereafter. Unfortunately, I woke to find the whole town plastered with huge placards of Verona FC v England, and fairly soon as I was changing to go down to the ground, I was told there were riots going on outside it because the Italians were trying to charge money for entry, and both our soldiers and the Italian civilians were upset about that. So I arrived on the scene and told them that either they opened the gates or there wasn't any football match, which eventually they did, and we had quite an interesting game as a result. However, I was then reported to higher authority for the misdemeanour of letting this take place. Happily, however, the two people who were trying me, or the inquisition about it, was conducted by two Wickhamists who were football players, and I don't think I even got a black mark on my record. Certainly I didn't in another problem area with football, because we eventually, after we'd been quite a time in Verona, my company, and by then I was a company commander in my own right, and had been promoted to major with the unfortunate attachment temporary acting unpaid. So I did a major's job for a year and a half without ever getting a major's pay. But on this occasion we were sent right out to a lonely little village called Lavermond, which was within half a mile of it was the border with Yugoslavia, and with the Drava River flowing beside it. It was a very boring assignment, and so I got a football ground bulldozed, and we had a number of games between ourselves. At the border there was a sort of railway type barrier and two sentries either side, and one of the sentries rang me up and said that the Yugoslavs on the other side had got envious of seeing us play football and were asking if they could come and have a game against us. So again, out in the middle of nowhere and thinking that nobody could possibly know about this, I said, yeah, of course, tell them they can come 2 o'clock Wednesday or whatever. So again, I had just changed and was walking to the ground. Another frantic ring from the border control couple, who said that it looked as if the whole of Yugoslavia was wanting to stream over, with buses streaming back for miles. So in the circumstances, I said, oh well, better let them all come in and spectate the match. And out of the leading bus got 11 very large, physically tough looking men, all in beautifully white football clothes with a red star on their breasts, and I suspect that this must have been a divisional or possibly even an army team, that they were so good. We made an odd job lot by contrast, because we were wearing naffy equipment, which meant that our socks were all of different colours and with holes in them and so on. However, we put up a reasonable show and were not too badly beaten. And I then invited their players back to our very small little officers' mess, where I have to admit the drink flowed freely, and also the very large centre-half, into whom I'd been bumping most of the afternoon, threw his arms round me and said, we have played against each other, now we must drink against each other. Well, I'm not a great drinker, but one could hardly refuse a challenge like that. And in the middle of all this, my company sergeant major and a military policeman burst in, the company sergeant major saying they'd got a near riot because I told him to all the other spectators could have tea and wads in our big canteen. And they were now saying they couldn't see why, as was fairly obvious, their team was getting something stronger to drink. So I told him that to get them off back the other side of the border fairly rapidly. And the military policeman asked what the hell was happening. So, muzzy as I was, but making things up on the spur of the moment, I said, "Don't interfere with this cunning little plan I've got. We have got them over to find out from them what on earth is going on the other side of the border. And in the morning I will be sending this in triplicate to, I'm sure, very interested HQ, and I'm happy to send you a copy." So that ended it, and happily I heard no more from the HQ, having in my report managed to get one or two interesting things out of those who played and stayed with us for an enjoyable evening. So that passed off all right. Then my most memorable, and one in which I take pride, soccer match took place at Padua in Italy. There were some top English professional teams. In this case there was one team sent out to play against divisions and formations in exhibition matches so that there could be a big spectator interest and they could see all these great players who had won all their matches till they got to Padua. And then, happily, not only did we have quite a good collection of amateur players, but we had, in my view, the greatest footballer, or certainly the greatest forward of all time for England, Tom Finney. And we also had another professional player, a Welshman, and nine very enthusiastic and pretty good amateurs. And happily, overnight, the ground froze hard. So the situation, of course, was that the leading pros who'd come out from England were certainly not going to risk their future careers by spraining ankles or breaking legs on a frozen pitch. While Tom Finney, as always, was prepared to give 150%, even though it was a match of no great interest for him. And at half-time, we were actually leading 1-0. So in the half-time discussions, I did the usual well-played chaps, keep it going, and handed over to Finney, who did the tactical stuff. You've probably seen their right back can't turn on this ground, so if we push the left inside up here in the left wing, I can leave him stranded any time, and we'll do all our attacks down that side while it's like this. And the happy thing, after his tactical advice, we actually ended 5-0 up, and the very eminent team departed in high dudgeon, sending a letter to the Army magazine, which was called Union Jack, complaining about being asked to play under such terrible conditions. But anyway, we were happy that we'd managed to beat these eminent men 5-0. I was also fortunate, of course, because Tom Finney, as I say, became one of the greatest players of all time and was also one of the nicest men, which was why he was always known as Gentleman Tom, because while he was often fouled because of his skill, he never fouled anybody. He was also an exceptionally nice man and very talented. I even took him on his first fishing trip where he immediately caught fish, so he was obviously multi-talented. But I learnt from him, and we used to practice together even things like heading tennis, which greatly improved my heading. But Tom himself had been, he joined our division after being originally he had hoped to go with his brother to Burma, but instead he was first sent on a tank training course, and then when he was trained on tanks, he was sent out first to Egypt with a royal voyage of the Queen Elizabeth or Queen Mary, whichever it was. But when he arrived in Egypt, in the usual army way, far from being put first off on organising the sport or whatever, he was put in the cookhouse. But eventually somebody came to their senses and had him organising the sport in the area, and he stayed there until casualties became so heavy in Italy that they were looking for reinforcements from everywhere, and with his tank ability he was soon sent over to Italy, and finally was driving the small Honey tanks, which are very fast and very manoeuvrable but very lightly armoured, and of course because they're used for reconnaissance, they're usually out in front.